living death tree scratched at the sky with its spindly black branches. Then down the lane he went, from the pasture to the woods, following paths only he and his father and grandfather could see spread out before them. The farther into the woods he went, the bigger the world seemed to grow around him. The sunlight thinned as the trees twisted together, enclosing him in their shadows. And somewhere inside that private world, down in the ravine at the back of the woods, was his father. There had been crying that day, too, earlier. The boy was not able to stop thinking about it, and I watched the moments replay in his mind over and over as he walked. His mother's sobs, a burst of strangled pleas, the way she'd sounded as if her life were in danger. The boy had come down from his tiny attic bedroom to find his mother on her knees in the living room, her face buried in her old too early hands. The door in the mudroom slammed then, making the house shake, making the boy look up for a moment before his mother let out another sobbing sound and turned back to her, saying, "Mom? Mama?" And she lifted her red face to finally look at him. "Was he saying it again?" the boy had asked her. "Just give him some time," she'd said, nodding. "He'll walk it off in the woods. Give him some quiet." An hour had passed, though, and the boy's father hadn't returned, which was why he'd decided to set off to find him, to bring him home to his bean-snapping, worn-down-too-early mother, who he loved more than anyone in the world, who sometimes made him wonder what had ever made her marry his father, a steelworker who drank half his paycheck on the nights he received them, then came home to smash the glass of the picture frames that held photos of their family members, like his father's own mother, Grandma Plumy, who the boy missed sorely. Grandma Plumy had been gone for 3 years now, and in those 3 years, it seemed the boy's father had only grown more distant from everyone, had grown into a stranger, as if he and the boy had never known one another, held conversations, as if the father had not made the boy from his own body with the boy's mother. After Grandma Plumy's funeral, after Aunt Ethel took half of Grandma Plumy's jewelry, then left without a word, the boy's father had woken one morning to find that somehow he'd been cast as an actor in a life he could not remember making. He began calling the boy John instead of Johnny, in a tone that dripped battery acid, as if John were the name of a constantly returning door-to-door salesman. He began to tell the boy's mother that he'd made a mistake by marrying her, that his own life was one great big mistake, that his own father, who had never come home from the war in France, who had died over there, should have never made him. "This world," the boy's father would say, "this world isn't worth spit, I tell you." And when the boy's mother said, "John, don't talk like this," the boy's father would cry and say he was sorry and that he was a coward. He'd never done anything right. He hadn't gone to fight in a war like his father had. The army had refused him, said he had a slight curvature of the spine and a murmur in his heart, and that he was too old, really. And though all of his wife's younger brothers had gone to Vietnam for a war that was unwinnable, they'd still done their duty. They'd done something honorable, even though all but one of them died over there, just like his father had died in the service of his country. And on top of that, he was losing his inheritance, the farm. He had taken to selling it off in pieces, one parcel when he needed to buy a new tractor, another when he needed a new car. Part of the woods, even, had been sold off to loggers after he'd gambled away the last of the savings his father left him. More and more often, the boy would find his father in dark corners of the house, his head buried in the palms of his hands, shaking. And once, when the boy went out to feed the cows, he'd stopped pouring the grain into their buckets when he heard an odd noise come from above, and realized quickly that it was someone crying. Someone up in the hay mound. Whimpering, really. That day, he left the barn and went to his bedroom in the second floor of the yellow farmhouse, and watched from his window, waiting to see who, if anyone, would eventually emerge. And when the gate did finally swing open, it was his father, wiping his eyes one last time before he turned to lock the gate behind him. At the edge of the ravine, their destination, The boy and the black dog came to a stop to look down the footpath that led to his father's tree, blind at the bottom, where the boy could find his father any time he disappeared from the house now. He was down there again. The boy told the black lab to sit, to stay, and the dog went down on its haunches like a statue, while the boy carefully picked his way down the slope to the bottom of the ravine. It was when he reached the bottom that the boy spotted his father sitting against the base of his tree, his legs crossed, a revolver held against his temple. The boy froze, afraid to move another inch, not wanting to disturb him, not wanting the gun to go off. Just a while ago he had asked his mother, "Did he say it again?" after he'd found her in the living room sobbing. Yes, she'd said. His father had said it again. The thing he'd been saying for weeks now, it seemed. That he was going to correct the mistake God made of him. Now, here in Marrow's Ravine, was the first time the boy had actually seen his father appear as if he might actually do what he'd been threatening. The boy looked up to the side of the ravine, to the black lab waiting for him on the ridge above, its pink tongue lolling. And then suddenly, beside the dog, he saw the curve of wide white antlers appear before the broad white head bearing those antlers followed. There was a creature up there, a creature the dog didn't seem to notice, and it stared down at the boy with eyes so dark and so cold, it seemed like it could see right into the center of the boy's soul. It was when the boy turned to look up at the top of the ravine that his father noticed him. The boy's father lowered the gun from his temple then. And at that very moment, when it seemed the man might return to his senses, he shook his head wildly, the hatchet of his nose shifting back and forth, and said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry." Then he flashed the gun into his mouth and pulled the trigger. The sound of the gun exploded in the boy's ears, pushing every other noise, every bird's call, every squirrel's chatter, even the trickling of Sugar Creek itself out of Marrow's Ravine. And after the echo of the blast and the ringing of the gunshot began to sift back down from the treetops, a deep stillness remained, quietly filling the place like a fog, as if the woods themselves had been shocked into a resolute silence. The boy stood there, staring, his eyes wide, his lips parted for the sharp breath he'd taken right before he watched his father's unstrung puppet of a body slouch against the base of the tree, head slumping against the shoulder. Gone now. Gone from him. I stood there with him, my own eyes wide, my own mouth hanging open, shocked into silence, until I heard my father crying, and turned to see him fall to his knees, covering his face with his hands. I watched my father, younger than I was now, placed the back of his hand against his eyes to wipe away tears that wouldn't stop coming. Watched as he heaved and sobbed at the foot of his own father's body. I couldn't stop myself any longer. I reached out from the shadows I hid within, reached out to try to touch him, to put my hand on his shoulder. Tried to take his hand from his eyes, to hold him, to bear some of his grief for him. But no matter what I did, I couldn't get through to him. It was just like our life together back in my time, back in my world. He couldn't see me. I knew he sensed me, though, because a second later he said, "Sophia? Is that you? Are you still up in New York with your father? If you can, would you do that thing? That trick with the star? Would you come home right now? I need you so bad." I furrowed my brow, confused. What trick was he talking about? It sounded like the story my mom had told me about the probable stone. The star, she said, could lead me home if I ever needed it. So she had told my father, too, back when they were high school sweethearts. Because how else would my 16-year-old dad seem to know my mom could do some trick that would let her come home to Temperance from some other place with a snap of her fingers? Seeing that he knew that all those years ago, though, it didn't make sense. Why had my mom taken all of that knowledge she'd obviously once shared with him and made him forget it? I couldn't probe to ask that question. I couldn't get that answer from my dad's younger self, because even as I knelt beside him and clutched his shoulder, trying to reach him, a curtain of rain began to fall around me, harder and harder, colder and colder, and then the vision of my dad faded altogether. I woke back into my body, back into my bedroom, completely drenched, to find my mom standing over me with the watering can she used on her houseplants, pouring water on me as I lay there. She was shaking her head, her lips curled in anger. Then when I was done blinking the vision out of my eyes, she said, "I cannot believe you, Aiden Lockwood. You promised you'd watch over me. I could have been hurt. I could have been trapped if something bad had happened. And you could have been trapped in there too, seeing something you shouldn't be seeing." "I'm sorry," I said, and sat up against my headboard. "I just wanted to help, and you won't let me. You won't even teach me about the things I can do." My mother scoffed. Seriously, she scoffed, then turned to look out my bedroom window, as if she couldn't stand the sight of me any longer. After a long pause, she turned back and said, "I took care of my business in there. The blizzard is over. What happened to you while you were in there? Did you even direct the journey, or did you just let anything come to you?" "I saw something," I said, relieved she was done hammering me for trying to follow her. "What exactly?" "I saw Grandpa," I said, which made her flutter her eyelashes in disbelief. "Dad's father," I specified. "Grandpa John, in the picture downstairs." My mom raised her eyebrows at that one and released a held breath. "Really?" she said. "And what did he have to tell you?" "He said he was going to correct the mistake God had made of him," I whispered. And my mom's face fell as if I just told her someone she loved had died unexpectedly. I told her the rest of the vision then. Told her about seeing my dad as a 16-year-old. Her mouth quivered into the hint of a smile as I described him to her. Described him as the boy she'd fallen in love with as a young woman. But as I neared the moment when my grandfather actually pulled the trigger, my mother said, "Stop. I know this part of the story. I know all too well what happens next." "What does it mean?" I asked. "Why was the white stag there again?" "You saw it in the world's shadow when you visited your great-grandfather in the war, too," my mom said, nodding. "But I don't know what it all means." Which I didn't believe for a second. "You have to know," I said. "I know you do. There are all kinds of things you won't tell me. Like, how did you stop the blizzard?" "Aiden," she said. But I could tell she was just about to lead me down a path away from what I wanted to know. "And why do you think someone made it happen?" I said, continuing to press her. "Better yet, who?" "Aiden," she said. Then her eyes began to narrow. "It's not fair to keep these things from me," I shouted. "I deserve to know what's going on here, too. I'm part of this, whether you like it or not." My mom squinted at me then, and the angry curl returned to her lips. "Don't talk to me about what's fair," she said. "You don't know what other people have gone through, what other people have sacrificed to protect you and give you this life. Maybe you had this vision for a reason that has nothing to do with the white stag. Maybe you needed to see what you saw so you can understand why your father is who he is, why he does so much for you. Maybe you need to think about how it would feel to lose your father at such a young age, like your dad did. He took care of your grandmother and this farm after that happened. He took care of me after we got married. And he's taken care of you and your brother, never giving himself a chance to think of any other life for himself. How fair is that, Aiden?" I didn't answer. I sat there silent, ashamed, until she huffed, angry that I'd managed to push her this far. And in the next instant she stormed out, shaking her head, as if she couldn't believe she'd raised a son as ungrateful as I was. The next day, I drove over to Jared's to pick him up for school like usual, now that the roads were clear and the blizzard was over. But when I arrived, instead of waiting for him, I turned off the Blue Bomb's engine, went up to the door, and knocked until it swung open and Jared stood before me. "Is your mom home?" I asked. He shook his head. "Working a double to make up for all the days off during the blizzard," Good, I said, and stepped up to stand beside him in the doorway, our faces inches from each other. Why don't we skip school today? Horror movies and making out sounds better. Jared laughed, as if he couldn't believe what I'd just proposed. Then, when I didn't laugh with him, he said, What? Is my good boy turning bad on me? When I only grinned in answer, his face changed to something more curious, and he said, I thought you wanted to take things slow. To be careful. That blizzard, I told him, was sent here by someone or something, according to my mom. She's the one who stopped it. Okay, he said, waiting for me to go on. So you know, I said, that someone or something is apparently out to get my family. It seems we have enemies. Enemies who can conjure up blizzards. I figure I better not waste any more time, if something like that is really out there. Wait, Jared said. Are you saying... But I didn't let him finish. I put my hand over his lips for a second and said, Horror movies and making out. Then I removed my hand only after I'd leaned in to kiss away whatever question he'd almost asked me. I didn't know the answer to that question anyway. I didn't know much about anything, really. Not nearly enough about my own family. Not enough about the secrets my mother kept from me. Not enough about myself or whatever else I might be capable of doing. But when I put my hand on his waist and pulled him closer, I knew exactly this one thing. Him and me. Together. Chapter 9. The Trail of My Father's Blood. At school, Jared and I shared smiles that held secrets. No one knew about us. Not the us we were beyond those hallways and classrooms. And I figured that was probably how we'd continue to be, as long as we lived in Temperance. Or at least as long as we were in high school. But I was starting to understand that we could be who we were together, regardless of whether we stayed forever in a town as small and changeless as ours. If my mom decided to go psychic on me, though, and read those particular thoughts, she would disagree. She had always been a true believer in Temperance. She said the people here were the salt of the earth. But they probably would have been more like salt rubbed into a wound if they knew my and Jared's secret. Small towns in remote corners of the world are really quaint, unless you don't fit into them. Then they're just small. I'd never really had a friend here, not like Jared. Or at least, I couldn't remember any after my mom pushed them away from me, blocked them from seeing me, the same way she'd blinded me to the invisible world. The salt-of-the-earth people of Temperance my mom always defended had mostly treated me like I was invisible over the past 5 years, except for those times when I spaced out in class, thanks to my mom screwing my head up, and then I was all too visible, and everyone got in a good laugh. When I thought about it so hard my brain would start to tremble toward a migraine, I knew that if Jared hadn't come home, I'd have been lost forever. Aimlessly driving my car around town in circles, hoping I'd find my real life waiting just around the corner of this false one my mother had given me. I would never have found myself without Jared to help me remember that I wasn't as thin as paper. To help me remember there was more to me than even I knew. I stopped telling myself that things would get better, like I'd been doing for weeks at that point, and I thought that was wise of me, considering the fast turn my life had taken into seriously weird central. Now I told myself to get ready for whatever was coming next, because things were coming. I could feel that the same way my mom felt things, hours, days, weeks, or years ahead of time. Only these things were not good. Whatever was coming for my family was done playing with us. The next time it came, it would do its worst. In early January, my dad and Toby started gearing up for their last go at deer season. They did this every year, hunting together down in Merrow's Ravine, where my dad and his father and grandfather had all hunted. My dad's stand was a well-traveled route for deer. There was a buck or a doe each season, guaranteed meat in the freezer, another rack hanging on one of the walls of our house if it was something special, And if you had an old man who had claimed a place that never failed to bring out the deer, you could count yourself lucky to inherit that place when his hunting days were over. That was how my dad got his place in Merrow's Ravine, just a mile trek back through our woods and down a steep slope to the center of that forest. He'd inherited the spot from my Grandpa John, the man whose eyes constantly followed me around our living room. When my Grandma Benny was still alive, living down the hall in the extra bedroom, I once asked her what he'd been like. "He was a shy fellow," she told me. "Never did well talking to most people." She smiled then, looking beyond my shoulder at the tree line behind the fields of clover in our backyard, and said, "That's what I liked about him. He was all mine when I had him." This stand of his, this place that must have been a crossroads for deer in northeastern Ohio, had been handed down to him by his father, the man who had jumped out of an airplane on D-Day, a man who had chased the white stag into the woods until he found death waiting for him in his own reflection. My mom and I were often alone those first 2 weeks of January, and as my dad and Toby drifted through the woods and crouched in tree stands, I started to ask her questions. Questions I hadn't been able to ask when they were around because of my promise to keep her secrets. "Can you tell me more?" I asked one evening, before they'd come home from the woods. She was sitting in a wing-backed chair in the living room, reading something on her tablet. When I asked the question, she looked up and stared at me, blank-faced, possibly annoyed, before saying, "What is it you want to know?" "Whatever I need to know," I said. "You can't sit there and deny that something is out there looking for us. You've said so yourself. And besides, I'm putting things together on my own. Things are finding their way to me. Whether you're going to help or not doesn't matter." She placed her tablet on the table beside her, then turned back to me with a pinched expression. "What things exactly are finding their way to you?" she asked, almost as if she didn't believe me. "You gave me back the memory of the man in the black suit," I said, "and I'm at the white stag in the world's shadow. I watched my great-grandfather die. I watched Grandpa John over there shoot himself." I turned to look at my grandfather's portrait for a moment, met his eerie stare, then turned back to my mother. "There's plenty coming to me, and I know there's more. I just want to understand. I want to know how I'm a part of everything." "I've already told you," my mother said flatly. "The man in the black suit and the white stag are agents of death." "But why? Why did I see them? Why not some skeleton wearing a hooded cloak and carrying a sickle?" "There are as many harbingers of death as there are different kinds of people in the world. They come in forms people have given them over the years, depending on how they see them. The white stag runs through your father's family. Ironic, isn't it, for a clan of hunters? It carried you home because you have Lockwood blood running through you. It recognized you. And when you die, you'll either be led across the way by the stag or by the agent from my family, Old Black Suit. Whichever one holds more sway with you will come." "I want the stag," I suddenly found myself saying. "Why?" my mother asked, cocking her head to the side, curious. It didn't seem as creepy as Old Black Suit. "Old Black Suit," my mother said. "Maybe unnerving, it's true. But at least you can reason with him. The stag, well, let's just say it's the agent for your father's family for a reason. Like the Lockwoods, the stag can't be swayed beyond its purpose." "Thank you," I said, "for talking to me like this. I mean that." Instead of saying you're welcome, though, my mom simply pursed her lips before asking, "Is there anything else, then?" As if she were a sales clerk at a store counter. "You never told me how you stopped that blizzard," I said, not letting her tone offend me, trying to press her for as much information as possible. My mom sighed and looked down at the tablet on the end table, as if she'd rather be reading. When she looked up again, she said, "It's complicated, Aiden." "Why can't you just tell me what we're dealing with?" I said, and I could hear my voice climb a little higher. because it will change everything I've done to protect you. It's not possible. Just bear with me a while longer. I'll fix things right, I swear. Then why don't you start by teaching me what I can do? I asked. I've been burning to ask her for weeks now. Aiden, she said, you don't want to know these things. Trust me. Trust that I would put all of this down if I could. She looked at the Christmas tree in the corner of the room then, at the strings of lights still glowing, and the ornaments still hanging off the branches. We should probably take that down, she said. Shouldn't we? Another closed door, I realized. Another dead-end discussion. I could have continued to press her, but I knew by my mom's tone that she was finished, that the only thing I'd get from her at this point was either going to be a moment of pretending to be close like we'd been when I was a little kid, taking down the tree, rehashing holiday memories, or else a heated, hurtful argument. So I nodded, agreeing to help take down the tree, agreeing to let her change the subject. I spent the next hour with her, removing the satin bulbs and gingerbread, the cords of lights and the ornaments constructed with toothpicks and popsicle sticks, things Toby and I had made back in elementary school. That I had ever been so small, so young, so unknowing was hard for me to believe. Where had all the time gone, and how did it go so quickly? Or had it gone anywhere? Had it instead taken on a particular shape? Had we somehow molded time into these childish ornaments with our tiny hands and stored it that way, held inside them? My mom had difficulty getting rid of things that had to do with her kids. Photos, essays, finger paintings, athletic trophies, 4-H ribbons. So when I commented on how the ornaments we'd made as kids were shoddy and should probably be thrown away, she said, "One day you'll want as many of these things as you can get." And when I asked why, she said, "Because they'll remind you of who you are when you forget yourself." "I've already forgotten myself, though," I said. And she looked at me through the branches like I'd just slapped her. A fight was about to break out, but I'd made a fair assessment of my life right then, I felt. Hadn't she admitted to hiding memories from me? Hadn't she avoided telling me more when I'd asked just an hour earlier? Before she had a chance to argue, though, the back door slammed open so hard it shook the entire house. A second later, Toby burst into the living room where we'd been plucking candy canes off the tree branches. His face glistened, his cheeks were flushed red, and his eyes were filled with terror. His lips trembled as he tried to speak, and when he finally got his mouth open, he shouted the words, "He's dead! Oh my God, Dad's dead!" My mother didn't panic when Toby burst into the room with those words spilling out of him. She didn't lose one ounce of control. She simply put the candy cane she was holding back on the branch and said, "Calm down, Toby. What's happened?" And when Toby was able to explain that our dad had fallen out of his tree stand and wasn't moving, my mom went straight to the kitchen to call Sheriff Behrens to tell him about what might have occurred down in Merrill's Ravine. There were a few tears in her eyes as she spoke, but her voice held steady. "Yes, well," she kept saying over and over. "Yes, well," she finished the call by saying she was going down to the ravine to see about the truth of the matter, and that she'd meet him there. Sheriff Behrens must have told her not to go, though, because she said, "I'm sorry, but you know I have to do this." While they spoke, Toby sobbed on the couch, hunched over, fists tucked into his armpits. He was wearing his orange camouflage snowsuit and hunting hat with furry ear flaps. The suit was covered in mud, as if he'd stumbled and fallen into water, making me think of our great-grandfather drowning in that creek in France. "Toby," I said, "what happened?" But he only shook his head. Snot dripped from his nose, and no matter how many times I asked, he wouldn't answer. I'd never seen my brother like this before. I'd never seen him so reduced, so afraid. When my mom came back from talking to the sheriff, she sat beside Toby on the couch and put her hand on his shoulder, gently, as if he might break, as if her touch would call him back to us. "You need to calm yourself," she said, taking off his orange cap and pushing away the sweaty hair from his dirt-speckled forehead. You need to calm yourself so you can take us back to your father. We need to find him. We need to help him right now.
I can't, Toby spat through gritted teeth. I fell halfway down the ravine when I went to check on Dad. I lost my phone in the fall, or I would have just called you. I think I either twisted or broke my ankle.
Show me, my mom said. And Toby reached down, gritting his teeth harder, and his face turned an angry red color as he pulled the boot off. The flesh of his ankle was purple and swollen. My mom felt around it for a while, squeezing gently in different places, asking what he could feel and what he couldn't, asking if he could move the ankle in certain ways. It reminded me of the jellyfish squish of bone I'd heard in my great-grandfather's foot after he'd landed from his plane jump. When my mom was done, she looked up at Toby and said, "It's not broken, I think, just badly sprained." Then, turning to look up at me, she said, "Aiden, you'll have to come with me."
"Me?" I said.
"I can't do it alone," she said. "I need you to help me find your father." Her tone was remarkably calm, but I'd never heard her say she needed me before. Not like this. Not with this careful, hidden dread in her voice. I nodded.
"Okay," I said. "Let's go, then."
"He's not dead," my mother said as soon as she closed the mudroom door behind us and the cold air began to fog around our warm bodies. I looked at her, bundled in a thick barn jacket and a black men's stocking cap, a blue scarf twisted around the bottom half of her face, and could see the severe expression in her eyes that meant she wouldn't allow any other idea to exist as we began to silently trudge through the snow a moment later. I listened to our boots crunch through the icy crust with each step that we took, and tried to imagine a world in which my dad was no longer alive. It wasn't possible. Toby had to be wrong. He had to be. After my mom and I had been trudging on like that for a while, lost in our own heads, I decided to finally break our silence. "How do you know for sure?" I asked, giving her a sidelong glance. "How do you know he's not dead?" "Because," my mother said, not missing a beat in her step, "I would have felt him leave this world.
And besides, he's been hidden. Protected."
"Protected from what?" I asked. But my mom just stared for a second, like I said the stupidest thing in the world. I didn't say any more. I kept my head down and pulled one leg in front of the other, over and over, punching through the snow. My breath came out in plumes as we pushed back through the frozen pasture, back through the ice-crusted lane that would take us into the woods. "Do you know where we're going?" I asked when we did finally reach the edge of the woods a while later, in the same place where, several months earlier, on a cold autumn night, the white stag had knelt down to let me slide off its back. "I have a general idea," my mom said. "But I haven't been down to Marrow's Ravine in years. When's the last time your father took you?" I thought about it for a second. The last time Dad had taken me down to Marrow's Ravine had been a year ago, when I was a junior and he and Toby had been excitedly talking about going back to screw steps into their trees and climb into the branches to set up their stands. My mom had stood in the living room watching them gear up for the journey, and unexpectedly she'd suggested that my dad take me with them. "What for?" my dad had asked, looking from her to me like there was something wrong with both of us. "Aiden doesn't hunt." "Maybe he'd just enjoy the walk," my mom had offered. "Maybe he'd enjoy seeing what you two see back there." My dad had grudgingly agreed, nodding and chewing his bottom lip like he'd been forced to pick a not-so-likely classmate for a gym team. But I'd suited up quickly, not wanting to annoy him further, because he and Toby were already almost ready. Then we went back to the pasture and back to the woods, with the trees stretching up tall and dark around us, until we reached the edge of the ravine, a mile or so from our back doorstep. Then we climbed down the side of the ravine, using the spots where my dad's and his dad's and his granddad's feet had worn a trail of steps into the earth over their decades of hunting, to find the tree my father would use for his stand. Toby's place was on top of the ridge, where he could look down and see my dad at the bottom. The plan was, if a deer got past my dad, it would run up to the ridge, where it would think it was safe, and then Toby would have a chance to take it. "It's been over a year," I told my mom. "I've never come back here in winter, not since I was a kid, and Toby and I used to play down there sometimes." My mom brushed a strand of wind-blown hair out of her face as we pushed farther into the woods. "We'll have to keep our eyes open then," she said. "These eyes," she pointed back and forth between our eyes with two fingers. "And this eye, too," she added, pointing from her forehead to mine. We drifted for what seemed like forever, lost in a vast white desert where none of our eyes seemed to do us any good. After a while, my mom seemed to be on the verge of giving up hope. I could tell she was worried that my dad's condition was getting worse, that every second that passed made it more likely he would slip out of his body and leave this world behind him. I could see her thoughts as she formed them, as if they were no more than strands of yarn, a cat's cradle inside her mind instead of strung between her fingers. Usually my mom had all kinds of shields up to guard her thoughts and feelings. Now, though, with her attention focused on my dad, seeing into her mind was like looking through a pane of glass. We stumbled through snow-laced underbrush, licking our chapped lips, blinking ice out of our eyes, until finally I found a set of deer tracks, a pair of holes punched through the snowy crust. And there were flecks of blood in the snow, too, as if maybe the deer had been hit, and the tracks remained, as if no amount of snowfall could erase them. I looked up from the tracks, turned in the direction they came from, and for a moment I thought I saw a deer running toward me, as if it were charging right at me. I startled as it came at me, jerked to the side a little, but before it could reach us, it broke apart like smoke, and I could only hear the ghost of its hoofbeats as it passed, drumming and drumming as it ran in the direction of the farm. "Did you see that?" I asked, turning to my mom. She shook her head, squinted at me for a second. "What did you see?" she asked. I didn't want to tell her I'd seen a ghost deer, that I'd heard its hooves as it ran past. If it was the white stag, it might be a sign that things were bad for my dad. So I told her I'd seen a glow coming from up ahead, that it might be where sunlight broke through the woods because the ravine widened and separated the tree canopy. She nodded and said that sounded like a smart idea, and from there I took us in the direction the deer tracks came from. Clutching her coat tight near her neckline, my mom let me take the lead, and after 20 minutes we'd done it. We'd reached the ridge that looked over Merrow's Ravine. I could see my dad from that high up, even through the snow flying in my face, even through the branches of the trees that sprouted up on this side of the ravine. He was face down in the snow, one arm flung out at an odd angle, and the falling snow had already begun to cover him. My mother gasped, then covered her mouth with her hand while tears formed and streaked down her wind-chapped face. She put her other hand on my shoulder to steady herself. "You did good," she said, without looking at me, without removing either hand from where it had settled. Then, after she caught her breath, we began the climb down. On the way, I kept wishing that I had stopped my mom from bringing me with her. I kept wishing that I'd called Jared and asked him to come over. Right now, he could be holding me as he told me none of this was really happening, that what I was about to face when I reached the bottom of the ravine was all in my head. I wanted him to tell me that I was crazy. Crazy at that point would have been preferable to the reality in front of me. But my wishing was futile. I didn't know how to wish something into or out of existence. My mother had refused to teach me. So instead, I found myself holding my mom's hand, helping her pick her way down the side of the ravine. It felt like I was watching it all happen from outside my own body, like it had felt when I'd fallen into the world's shadow and watched my great-granddad fall through the air over a French battlefield. My breath came faster, then harder, and steam poured out of my mouth like smoke from a stack. I could hear my own heartbeat as we reached the bottom, and I could hear it stop for just a moment, skipping a beat when we came to stand next to my father. We found him almost directly below his tree stand, his rifle emerging from a crust of snow a few feet away, his shape still visible, like the curves of a body beneath a white sheet. A trickle of blood had leaked from his mouth and was frozen against his bristly jawline. And when I saw the blood, I let out a gasp like my mother had when she'd seen him from above. My breath curled away in wispy tendrils as reality settled in like a dark seed, one that would take root and grow a black and thorny vine around my heart in the days to come. It was then that I noticed that the tracks I'd followed to the ridge were down here too, around my father's body. It looked as if the deer that had made them had found him before we did, had circled him, sniffing, trying to make sense of the human at the bottom of the ravine, the steam lifting from his body. There was a trail of blood in the snow between the hoofprints, a thread of red leading away from the spot where my father lay motionless. My mother didn't seem to notice it, but I saw it clearly. It led up the side of the ravine in the direction we'd come from, and was surely the blood I'd seen half a mile back. My mom bent down to place one hand on my father's shoulder, but her legs gave way beneath her, and she fell to her knees in one fast motion. She let out a short, sharp moan then, and touched the back of my dad's head. "Oh," she whispered, shaking her head, trying to deny what lay in front of her. "Oh, my love, we had time left. I was saving it up. I had heaps and heaps of time saved for us." We stayed for a while like that, my mom kneeling in the snow next to his body. My head bowed as if I'd found myself in a vision, silent, unable to participate in the events going on around me. Eventually my mom looked up with her mouth open, her lips trembling, as if for the first time in her life she didn't know what to say. "We have to go," she managed to say. "We have to go back so we can get him home before nightfall. I won't leave him out here like this." The walk home felt longer and slower, especially having to climb the side of Marrow's Ravine instead of picking our way down. I held my mother's hand most of the way up, leading her to the safe places to plant her next step, and eventually we reached the top, exhausted both by the climb and by the constant awareness we had to maintain on our way up. I could see how easy it would have been for Toby to stumble and fall, especially thinking that our father was dead or dying. He was lucky, really, that he'd done nothing more than sprain his ankle badly. We followed our own tracks back through the woods in silence. Every now and then, I'd try to catch a look at my mom with a sidelong glance, and her face was always hard, red, and angry. She looked like she might tear a bear limb from limb if one happened across our path. I almost hoped we'd run across the sheriff on our way back, just so I wouldn't be alone with her in her barely contained rage. But he was nowhere in sight, so I stayed quiet as we trudged back through our own footprints. Until we came to the place where I'd noticed the deer tracks, tracks my mother hadn't been able to see when we'd gone back to find my father, tracks she still couldn't see as we returned, tracks with the trail of my father's blood winding between them. Then she stopped suddenly and turned to me with that angry face and said, "You saw something here, didn't you?" I shook my head, not wanting to make her angrier than she was already. "Yes, you did," she said, nodding, trying to encourage me now with a softer tone to tell the truth. "Tell me, Aiden, what did you see when we were on our way down there?" "A deer," I admitted. "A deer like a ghost. It just came right through here, then disappeared in a puff of smoke." "The stag?" she asked. "It was fast," I said. "It didn't seem as real to me as when I've seen it in the world's shadow, but it could have been. It happened so quickly." My mother looked around, trying to pierce the veil of the present into the past to see what I'd seen. "I don't understand," she said. "I don't understand why you would see that and I wouldn't." "It might have been nothing," I said, They could have been entirely random. I put my hands in my armpits to signal that I was cold, standing there, to see if I could get her moving again, but she didn't budge. Instead, she stared at me hard for a long moment, and then she said, "Don't keep things like that from me, you hear?" And in a moment of complete exasperation, I said, "Why not? You keep things to yourself. You hide things from all of us." She breathed out of her nose heavily then, squinting at me like I was a stranger who had offended her. Clearly I'd become one of those children whose parents look at them one day and suddenly realize they've become their worst enemies. "If you see things that I can't," she said a second later, "I need to know what they are, or we may never get to the bottom of this. Whatever happened to your father doesn't feel like a simple accident to me. Okay?" "Okay," I said, and stood there, not knowing what else to say, afraid to say anything, afraid that I might choose the wrong word, a word that might attract whatever had killed my father. At least I thought she was giving me a rationale with her orders, much better than how she usually responded when questioned. "That's for me to know and for you to find out." Maybe, I thought, we could work together, if she could just see me, if she could recognize me as an adult. "Okay," I said again, nodding. And then we continued our trek home. When we finally reached the house, we found Sheriff Behrens waiting with Toby, and after we made arrangements for the sheriff to go back and bring my father home, I called Jared. "Did you know this was coming?" he asked on the phone. "No," I said. "Neither did my mom. She swore she'd know if my dad had died, but she didn't." "If one person in the world would know something like that," Jared said, "it'd be your mom." "I'm sorry, Aiden. I don't know what to say. Can I do anything?" "You can come over," I said, thinking of the wish I'd made earlier. The wish that would have erased this day and left me sitting on my bed with Jared, him holding me, telling me everything would be okay. "I'll borrow my mom's car," was all he said before disconnecting. When Jared showed up 20 minutes later and rang the bell, my mom reached the door before I could. And when she opened it and found him standing on her front porch with his hands in his pockets, his mouth hanging open a little because he'd expected me to answer, she said, "Why are you here?" As if he might have done all this. As if he had caused my dad's fall. And all Jared could say was how sorry he was for her. How sorry he was for all of us. "I asked him to come over," I said from the landing between the first and second floors. My mom turned to look up at me. Her face was white, as if all the blood had drained out of her in the last few hours, and her mouth was open in surprise, like Jared's. When she looked away from me and back at Jared, she mumbled, "You were the only one. You were the only one who wasn't a part of the story." "Excuse me?" Jared said. My mom walked away, though, shaking her head, leaving the door open and Jared standing on the front porch with his black stocking cap pulled down over his ears and the snow falling gently around him. I shook my head as she walked out of the foyer into the living room where she'd built a fire. She'd been staring into the flames since Sheriff Behrens left, as if the orange and red licks charring the logs might hold the answers she wanted. "Come on up," I said to Jared after she was out of sight. Then I waved him toward me. When Jared came into my room with me, he closed the door gently and said, "What did your mom mean back there, about me being the only one who's not part of the story?" "I'm sorry," I said, shaking my head, unable to believe how rude she'd been, and for no apparent reason. "She's been like this since we found him. She's not making much sense right now." "That's understandable." Jared pulled his arms out of his coat and hung it on the back of my door, then came over to sit with me on my bed, just like I'd wanted, and we leaned back against the headboard together. He put one arm around my shoulders and squeezed me close, put his chin on top of my head, kissed my hair softly. "How about you?" he said. "How have you been?" "It wasn't just an ordinary accident," I said immediately.
What do you mean? I still saw the trail of blood leading away from my father's body, that thin red ribbon. It had wound up the side of Merrow's Ravine and through the woods, a crimson thread on the snow. The thread my father had left for me to follow, I'd already decided. The thread that would lead me to discover who or what had killed him. I want to go with you, Jared said after I told him what I was going to do. I don't think you can, actually.
Why not?
He said, pulling back to look me in the eye, to challenge me a little. Because, I said, I think the trail is going to lead me somewhere you can't follow. Somewhere not here. Somewhere not in this world.
Then I don't want you to go there,
Jared said, squeezing me tight again, as if he might weigh me down and keep me on this earth if he just held on to me. I buried my face between his neck and shoulder, felt the heat of his skin against my face, kissed him gently on his collarbone. And when I looked up, I said, I don't think either one of us has a choice. I have to do this. And you have to let me. 3 days later, this would happen. After the calling hours, after the funeral, after a couple of my father's friends from the roads department and one of his hunting buddies took up the handles of the casket with me and Toby, after my dad was lowered down into the earth, after my mom and Toby and I had deliberated over whether we would actually toss our handfuls of dirt on top of his casket, eventually letting the clods drop and watching his casket then be covered over with flowers, I went back to the woods again, back to follow the trail of my father's blood. His figure was still etched into the snow where he'd fallen, as if it were a permanent feature in the landscape now, and I knew it would always be there when I looked at the base of his tree in Merrow's Ravine, knew that where he'd fallen would forever be a marker of his absence. I stood there for a while, staring into the void his body had made in the snow, and wished that I'd never promised my mom I'd keep secrets from him. Secrets about myself that mattered. Now he was gone, and he'd never have a chance to know the real me. Never.
Back home, my mom was sitting at the dining room table with a white candle lit in front of her,
like I'd seen in a vision while we ate at that table as a family a few months earlier, before I could understand the things I'd begun to see and hear. She was searching the world beyond this one, trying to locate my father, wanting to make sure he was okay, trying to find answers. She'd been looking for him since we'd found his body, but she hadn't been able to find his spirit in the days that followed.
Where is he? Where is he gone?
She kept muttering, even in front of Toby, who she'd asked me not to talk to about things like voices and visions. Now it seemed all of her rules were broken, and she was the one breaking them. We'd gotten into a fight before I left that morning to head back to Merrow's Ravine. I was shrugging on my coat while she sat there, clutching her father's silver pocket watch like it might be a cross or a string of prayer beads, looking like a zombie as she stared into the flame of her candle.
You said not to bring up things like what you're doing around Dad and Toby, I told her.
Hush, she said without looking away from the candle.
Just that.
You always hush me, I said, continuing to push the issue. You always tell me to keep quiet.
I asked you to not say anything to them for your own protection, my mother spat.
Well, that didn't work out for anyone, I said.
Did it?
My mom slowly turned away from the candle to give me a fierce stare.
What are you trying to say here, Aiden?
I'm saying you made me promise not to tell Dad about what was happening, for our own good, but he died anyway. And now he'll never know me. Not the real me. Not the me you hid from everyone.
Aiden, she said, something outside of my control is happening here. You can't blame me for that.
Maybe you never had any control to begin with, I said. Maybe I shouldn't have ever trusted you after I found out how much you lie.
Then I turned and left, slamming the back door behind me.
My mother had gone blind to the invisible world, apparently. She couldn't contact my father's spirit. She couldn't see the thread of blood I'd seen back in the woods when we'd found my dad's body. Now I knew that the invisible trail had been left there just for me.
a secret message written in blood for one particular set of eyes to see. From the place where the thread started, where my father's blood had leaked from his mouth after the fall, I began to follow the trail back up the side of the ravine, back through the woods to the place where I'd first found hoofprints. And from there I followed the thread as it unspooled further, leading me back to the edge of the woods, back through the lane to the pasture, where suddenly the thread veered in a wide arc, and I followed it over the railroad tie bridge that spanned Sugar Creek, until finally it disappeared into the hole at the bottom of the living death tree. When I looked up from the trail of my father's blood and stared at the gnarled old apple tree in front of me, the voice inside its hollow core said, "I've been waiting for you. Come in." And I got down on my back, assuming that resistance at this point was fairly futile. The snow crunched beneath my weight as I began to slide backward along its surface, and then my head slipped through the hole at the bottom of the tree, which seemed to grow bigger and bigger as I pushed inside it, wider and wider, accommodating the width of my shoulders, until I had somehow fit myself inside the tree entirely, and then I was falling through darkness. Chapter 10. Sorrow Acre. In the dark, falling through the silence, I screamed. Screamed like I'd never screamed before. Screamed until my voice flew out of my mouth and floated like a silk scarf through the thousands of miles of dark above me. Then I landed, and the world shuddered. When I opened my eyes, I had to blink over and over, had to put my hands to my face to make sure my head was still there, that I was still real. Light had returned suddenly, so bright I felt shot through with arrows and crumpled up in a ball on the ground, feeling like one of my migraines might surge through my brain at any moment and wreck me completely. No surge came, though. Instead, I lay there, not moving, helpless to do anything but wait and watch, helpless to do anything but listen to the voice that whispered in my ear in that bright white void I'd landed in, unable to climb out. "This is the story," the voice of the living death tree said. "This is what binds you." Then another wave of light washed over me, even brighter, blinding me once more. And when my vision returned, this is what I saw. This is what she showed me. A young man strode down a coal-patched back road, lined on either side with towering silver maples. Light fell across their branches, oozed down to the tips of their leaves, collecting like sap, dripping. I stood beneath them, watching the heat and dust rise from the tar-spattered road in waves. The young man wore a wide-brimmed hat to shield his face from the sun. He took it off, though, when he stopped to look at the lamb that spread out before him. After wiping the sweat from his brow, he waved at an old man sitting on the front porch of a farmhouse, who nodded in return, then raised his hand, signaling the young man to come join him in the cool shadows. And by the time the last embers of light dipped below the tree line at the back of the farm that evening, the orchard, the corn, the hayfields, the creek that wound through the center of that place, even those ancient maples lining the road, everything the young man could see, he owned. His name was Lockwood, he told the Hodges family. Two sallow-faced elderly parents of a too-skinny adolescent daughter. They wanted to go down to West Virginia, where they had family, they said, and where they'd heard there might be work available in coal mines. Running a farm, Hodges